Hey guys, welcome back to the show. Hopefully you guys listened to the first episode. If not, it's up on the blog page. My name is Colin. With me is Dom. We're going to be going over what happened on the newest episode of Survivor. We're going to be going over what could have happened on the newest episode of Survivor and didn't. And then in the second half of the show, we're going to be going over some of the famous flips throughout Survivor history, because obviously a big factor in this season has been Cochran's decision to flip at the final 12. So with that, I'm going to bring in Dom. Dom, what's going on?
Hey, well, I thought this episode was pretty lackluster compared to the rest of the season, but it still has some good moments, particularly for people who are interested in strategy.
Definitely.
And that's more because of what failed to happen than what actually happened.
Sure. Well, let's go through what did happen. And what did happen, not very surprising, but still, you know, worth going over. What happened is two girls left, both Savai, and the pagonging continued. Now, what could have happened is an entirely different story, because with nine people left, that's a very critical point in the game of Survivor, and that's what we're really going to be getting into today.
And typically, the reason that you want to make something happen at the final nine is because if you're going to shake up the game, you want to do it at an odd number, ideally. If you try doing an even number, you need a bigger majority in order to win at the vote. So let's say it's a final eight. If you have a 4-4 split, it's a tie, so you need five people to get a majority instead of four. If you do it at the final nine instead, you still only need a five-person majority, except it's easier to set up and you have the final eight to fall back on in case you don't do it.
Right. And also at final nine, there can be no ties. Well, I suppose there can, but realistically. So anyway, that's a lot. Thank you for explaining that.
Right.
Coming into this episode, I had the players in a few different groups in terms of how I thought they would be voting, how things have been lined up. And in one group, I have Coach, and as you described them perfectly last week, his network of goats. Now, the word goat's often thrown around on Survivor forums, and it has two different kind of contexts. One is like a goat, which is an acronym for greatest of all time, G-O-A-T. That is not the goat we are referring to right now.
Right.
These are Rick, Brandon, and Edna. This is what we describe as Coach's network of goats, and Cochran may even be in there now. We'll get to that in a minute. Goats are people that will vote with you, will not turn on you, and that you will destroy at a final tribal council. So anyway, coming into this episode, I have one group being Coach, Rick, Brandon, and Edna, for sure. That's 4 out of 9 votes. They just need one more, and whatever Coach wants is going to happen. In another side, both Upolu, I have Albert and Sophie, because they're really the people we're going to be focusing on to now. And on the other side, I have Don and Whitney, former Savai, kind of hung out to dry at this point, and then Cochran. What do you think about those in terms of groups? Do you think Cochran's definitely in with Coach?
I think those groupings are pretty accurate. We don't really know. On this episode, it looked like Cochran was going to turn against the main core of Upolu if it was necessary. One of the reasons I think that Albert might have wanted to target Edna instead of Coach was that he thought he was more likely to get Cochran on board if it was someone like Edna, maybe Rick or Brandon, instead of Coach. So he might be assuming, based on stuff that we're not seeing, that Coach and Cochran are just too close to be broken up.
Now, actually, coincidentally, I was just reading through the thread which kind of inspired this podcast on 2plus2.com, best Survivor thread on the internet. Sansi each week posts secret recaps of the secret scenes that CBS airs. They didn't have time to air them during the actual episode, but if you go online, you can find all these secret scenes of things that also happened during the time that the episode showed. And one of the secret scenes, Albert said that he was just not messing with Don, but never really truly intended to vote out Edna, and was concerned because Don apparently approached him and said, why aren't we just going for Coach? If we're going to flip, let's go Coach. Let's get him out. Let's flush the idol out. But in order to make a flip happen at Final Nine, it required one John Cochran. And apparently Albert felt that Cochran was potentially too good with Coach, and that if Cochran rats him out to Coach about a potential flip, that there may be potential ramifications. But that's at least something where the whole Edna vote was apparently a diversion for editing purposes rather than something that Albert was ever genuinely going to try.
Right, and that makes a lot more sense, I think, than what would happen if he was actually targeting Edna, because if you're going to flip, I think you have to go the whole way and actually vote out Coach. As soon as you turn on Edna, Coach knows what's going on, and it should be easy for him to organize some sort of counterattack. Maybe not the final eight, given that they've had no time to prepare.
I'm sorry, I don't know how much time Coach really needs to prepare to launch a counterattack, because he's got 3 votes for sure that'll do what he says in Rick, Brandon, and Edna, at least at this point. And Cochran, where else is Cochran really going to go?
We've seen already that he doesn't want to force ties ever, because he's right. Scared to death of Rock. So if Coach, Edna, Brandon, and Rick are all voting the same way at the final eight, Cochran presumably is going to go with whatever they do.
Sorry, go ahead.
If I'm coach there, if I survive the final nine vote, as in if Edna is actually voted out, then I know for a fact that I'm safe at the final eight, because if they were going to split and vote me out, they would have done it in the final nine when I was at court unprepared.
So you think this is more just a move, if it were the Edna thing to actually come to fruition, it would just be a move to kind of take one number away from coach, maybe even the playing field a bit?
Possibly. The problem with that, though, is that when Albert and Sophie, who presumably would be them, when they flip over, coach has no incentive to trust him anymore. They've gone behind his back, they voted out one of his other closest allies. So it's not like they can just flip back over. Coach will trust Edna and Brandon and Rick, whichever of them are left, more than he'll trust Albert and Sophie. And rightly so.
Yeah, that's a fair point. It does come into play who's immune, and it turns out Sophie ends up winning the final nine immunity. So the question then becomes, what is Albert and Sophie? We're going to couple them together as a duo for the sake of this argument at least.
Okay.
What is their optimal play? And that's really what we're going to be getting into here. Should they be going for coach? And I want to know what you think.
As we covered briefly on last week's podcast, I think they should be going for coach. It's possible that coach is going to stick with them and going to take them to the final three, but he has no incentive to. And you, in Survivor, you have to act as if your opponents are going to think rationally, even if they've shown no history of doing that in the past.
Yeah, that's totally fair. So the problem becomes, there are nine people left. It takes five votes to get the majority, and coach seems to have four of those votes locked up himself, in himself, Rick, Brandon, and Edna. So it requires Cochran coming back over.
Right, so Cochran is basically the swing vote yet again. If Albert's read on him is accurate that he won't actually flip over and vote out coach, then in some ways it makes sense to just go along with the plan, continue the begonging, and hope that coach is actually true to his word, or that maybe he can do something in the final seven.
Yeah, and you know, next week's a recap episode, and in the off time between, well, I'm sure we'll see new footage, but in the off time between new strategic developments, we're going to be going over some of the famous final seven situations throughout Survivor history.
Right.
And by the way, the second half of this podcast, I wanted to make sure that I got this in there. Huge spoiler alert. If you haven't seen the previous seasons, I do not recommend listening to this if you want to watch them in the future unspoiled. So final nine, obviously we see it doesn't work out. Dawn ends up going home. What do you think about the Dawn versus Whitney?
I think Dawn's pretty easy decision there. Firstly, because as Albert said himself in the previous episode, she has a higher chance of flying under the radar, ingratiating herself with Polo, and just waiting for something to happen where she can maybe make a move to take control. In addition, she's shown herself to be very good at challenges, more so than you'd expect from someone of her age and some of her demographics more generally.
Certainly.
Whereas Whitney, is just going to sit there and get picklocked, no matter what happens.
Yeah, I don't see Whitney. Whitney was never really going to make a big mark on this game, other than as a number for potentially a reflip.
Right.
I don't think she was going to get anyone other than Keith's final jury vote, no matter how she got there, who she got there with. So just to solidify, we got a question from Jordan. He asked, should they, Albert and Sophie, have flipped at final nine? Who do they target? Verdict, yes. And coach?
Yeah. What would the other option be? It doesn't really make sense to target anybody else.
Yeah, I guess that's the point. And do you want to elaborate on why that would? I guess we already kind of covered that, on why it would kind of has to be coach. Otherwise, there's no real point other than taking control of the tribe. But if you're going to go for coach at some point, final nine was probably the time to do it.
Yeah, if you think about the reasons why you might want to vote out coach, one of the main ones is that he has a lot of control over people like Edna, Brandon, and Rick. That's also an argument in my mind for Albert and Sophie, I suppose, wanting to take coach out, because once coach is gone, they become the ones who can take control of those people.
Absolutely. And it's also, I think, worth noting that they know that coach has an idol in his back pocket anytime he wants it.
Right. And, you know, as the game goes on, it's going to get harder and harder to flush it out.
That's right.
Particularly because he has no reason whatsoever to play at the final eight, because if there were to be a move, it would have to go to the final nine. So if he survives this double tribal council, he's in the final seven with a group of people who are loyal to him and an idol. And he's a decent threat and challenges himself, so it becomes very difficult to get him out of the game at that point.
I agree. Yeah, coach should certainly not be, especially with Ozzy, Jim, and Don, who are probably his three biggest challenge threats from Savai. They're all gone now. Well, Ozzy's off on, and Don are off on Redemption Island, but he's not competing against them.
Right.
And if you look at the people he's competing against, who's really going to beat him besides Albert and, you know, Sophie, challenge beast, who knew?
Brandon is probably going to be good in any sort of strength challenge, but we haven't really seen many of them.
That's right.
Typically, actual challenge vets tend to be people who you might not expect. I remember in China, a lot of people said, oh, James is going to be a big challenge vet because, you know, look at how tall he is and how strong he is. But challenges are more than just tested brute strength and survival. You have endurance challenges, you have balance, puzzles, all types of things. And most of them require a combination of physicality and good strategic planning as well.
Anyone who doesn't remember James, probably the strongest survivor ever and an absolute beast when the challenges had to deal with strength, but was not great when they involved any other element, particularly intelligence. Not to be mean to James. So I have another question here from Matt, and he wants to know, he wants to say, at Final Nine, if they take out Brandon, he feels that that would then drastically reduce his coach's strength. Rather than taking out coach himself, what do you think about taking Brandon out at Final Nine?
Again, when Alb and Sophie flip, I think they have to go the whole way, because once you leave coach in the game, sure, you take out Brandon, who's someone who's close to him, but he still has Edna, he still has Rick, he still possibly has Parkman. So yeah. It just doesn't make any sense. You can take out Brandon later if you want to. If you're taking out Brandon at all, it's because your primary goal is to weaken coach. The best way to weaken coach is to get him out of the game altogether. As we both agree, there's not really much hope that coach would take Alvin Sophie back if they did flip on him and as he sees it, betray him.
And do you think there's any concern about coach maybe making a run on Redemption Island or no?
I don't think there is. Given the fact that Ozzy's there, given the fact that he's going to be, firstly, competing against other people. I mean, if you go about the Final Nine, he has to win duels to get back, presumably at the Final Five. So he has to win multiple duels to get there. And even when he gets back, he then has to win, you know, two challenges to make it to the end. So I don't think that's something to be scared of. If you're worried about him making a run on Redemption Island, then that's another argument for voting him out more quickly, because coach is basically food rolling at that point. If you vote him out sooner, he has to win on Redemption Island. If you leave him in the game and then vote him out later, he's basically in the same position, except he's further along in the trend.
Right. He doesn't have to win as many life or death duels.
Yeah.
Anything else for the Final Nine situation?
I don't think so. I think we're covered it.
Now, Final Eight was interesting because we had yet another famous survivor twist. Same twist we saw last year, which is at Tribal Council, they held yet another immunity challenge and voted out another person.
Right. I'm not a fan of this in general, just because I like it when the game gets shaken up, and forcing another vote immediately after one at Tribal Council just doesn't give people enough time to do that. Mm-hmm. Then again, from the producer's perspective, it was pretty certain that Whitney was going to go if she didn't win immunity. It's pretty certain that Cochran's going to go if she did. And I assume they just wanted to accelerate that process so that we could get to the fun stuff, which hopefully will come 2 weeks time in the Final Seven.
Yeah, in this situation, I don't think, like you said, I think Whitney had to win immunity. She doesn't, she goes. If exactly Whitney wins immunity, Cochran goes, and there's not much more to it. Right. So in that respect, I kind of appreciate them kind of fitting it into one episode. Let's see. So Final Eight, you know, given the circumstances, I don't think there was anything that could have happened. Do you think if it hadn't been this kind of accelerated turbo round that anything could have saved Whitney, assuming she did not win immunity?
I don't think so. For the reason we've covered, any sort of flip would have had to happen at an odd number, so Final Nine, and she wasn't going to make Final Seven without immunity. One interesting thing that might have happened is if I'm just some random person in Coach's line, I consider sort of putting a random vote on him just to stir things up a little bit, because Coach is the sort of person who it's going to get very paranoid about something like that, and who might go on a Lep-style rampage. So if I'm Albert or Sophie, I consider doing that there, just so that I have extra outs in case, you know, something random happens with Coach.
Yeah, that's certainly interesting. I think Coach can pretty easily pin any kind of mystery vote on one of those two, though, because I think he knows it's not going to be Rick, Brandon, or Edmund.
This is true. So it might be a better play for someone like Rick. Of course, the reason we're discussing it from the perspective of someone like Rick is he's never going to do something like that first.
Exactly.
Use this hypothetical.
A couple other things quickly from Matt. He wants to know, how useless is Ozzy coming back if he does indeed go on and just kill everyone at Redemption Island? Do you think he could make a run, or do you think he's just done unless he wins both immunities?
He's definitely done unless he wins both immunities. There's no way he sticks around, I think, under any circumstances.
Yeah, I tend to agree. He also wants to know
why Redemption Island is such a bad twist, because when it does work and someone makes it back into the game, wins immunities and makes it to Final Tribal Council, almost always they're going to win because they'll have gained respect from people who they beat. They'll have had one-on-one time with all those people who are now going to the jury.
Right. But, yeah. He doesn't have to get his hands dirty. He can provide, he can beat them at challenges like he's supposed to do, and he can get their votes at the finals.
Yeah. So when that happens, it kind of delegitimizes the game a little bit, in my view, because you have someone who hasn't had to deal with the strategy of the social element for, in Ozzy's case, it'll be about 2 weeks, and yet he's able to waltz into final tribe and collect the votes. And of course, when it doesn't work, it's just useless, because that person comes back and gets immediately voted out again. So there's having Redemption Island actually helped the season in the end.
Now, Ozzy mentioned, I believe to Jeff Probst in front of everyone, that Redemption Island is where he wanted to be for exactly those reasons. He can feed people, he can beat them, and then in the end, they're not mad at him because he did what he had to do to stay alive, and other people took them out when they could have voted someone else out. And so my question is this the best place for Ozzy, or do you think he'd be better served back in the game, dealing with the strategy, but at least having Redemption Island as an extra fallback rather than every challenge being life or death?
I think if that's going to be a good strategy for anyone, it's going to be Ozzy, because Redemption Island is more than just a fallback for him. I mean, he can reliably hope to go on the run there. Even so, though, why put yourself in that situation if voluntarily? There's just no reason to do it. He's free-rolling if he stays in the game. He's reverse free-rolling if he doesn't.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think as a general rule, it's never going to be better to be out on Redemption Island when your only plan for being in the regular game is to win every challenge. Anything more you have in terms of Final 9, Final 8, anything we saw last episode?
No, I mean, it was devoid of anything interesting strategy-wise, mainly because of what failed to happen. And also, there wasn't really much entertainment. We had Coach doing coachy things, as usual.
But yeah, and you know, understandably, not everyone's as big of a Coach fan as we are. And so I had told myself after the last episode that I'd try to tone down the Coach cheerleading. And obviously the first episode of the first scene of the new episode is Coach teaching Cochran the ways of Coach Chi. And I just couldn't let that slide. So I was really happy about that. I'm sorry for everyone who doesn't like Coach. I understand where you're coming from. I think he's great TV. And I thought that was a great scene. Truly one of Coach's greatest moments. But I promise you, we're both making a concerted effort to keep with the Coach cheerleading.
Yeah, although sometimes we can't really help ourselves. I mean, Coach realizes that all the most successful religious figures throughout history have had disciples. So he goes to Cochran, he teaches him the ways of the Coach or whatever, the ways of the Dragon Slayer. And I mean, even though I think there's a non-zero possibility that Coach is immortal, but when he dies, he'll have followers who will carry on his ideology.
Actually, Sansi posted on the thread from one of the secret scenes, Coach described Cochran, and I quote, "Cochran is the willing disciple. He seeks the inner peace. He wants to be molded. He wants to be coached. I sat down with him and just started pouring myself into him." And Cochran later apparently responded by saying that he was really pleased to have a moment with Coach, because I think as a fan, Coach is obviously going to be one of the biggest characters in Survivor history. And Cochran is happy that he gets to be in a moment, a signature Coach moment like Coach Chi. And I think it's kind of a relationship that's great for both of them. Coach has this little disciple and Cochran has an idol. A figurehead, really. So anything else in terms of the new episode now?
That covers it for this episode, I think.
All right. So I guess up next, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to be going over, after this, the most important, historical, memorable flips in Survivor history. Think Cochran's move at Final 12, flipping votes. We're going to be getting into that. Again, if you haven't seen the old seasons, I would highly recommend watching them. And then coming back and listening to this. But for those of you who have and love them and really want to look at them in depth, that's what we've got coming up for you next. I think that's it. Anything else to add before that?
No, that's fine, man.
All right, back right after this.
Okay, so welcome back, everybody. This is the segment where we're going to talk about some of the most notable strategic situations from Survivor history. Today we're going to be focusing on situations where one or multiple people have flipped over to new alliances or to alliances already been established. We're going to do that mainly because this has come up a lot this season. Firstly, obviously, with problems with Final 12. Secondly, the previous episode of Final 9, and we imagine that will come up again at Final 7 as well.
That's right. And, before we get into this, I just want to say I've been a Survivor fan for a really, really long time. You know, a ton of enthusiasm for this show. And I'm really glad that we now have this kind of venue to sit and talk about these things that I've wanted to talk about for 10 years. And, you know, hopefully the people listening feel the same way. And once again, just if you haven't seen these seasons, I highly recommend pausing this, going and watching them, and then coming back to us later. For those of you who have seen them, we're going to start about 10 years ago, and I'm going to let Dom bring it in.
Okay, so we're going to start with arguably the first ever flip, and this is Brandon Quinton's decision to flip at the Final 9 of Spider-Africa. So I'll set the stage for you a bit. We go into the merge with 4 and up 6-4. So we have Lex, Ethan, Tom, Kim Johnson, Kelly, and Clarence form 4 against former Sambu, which is Brandon, Kimpy, Frank, and Teresa. So at the final 10, Lex makes a move which is interesting in itself, I think. He decides to rally his troops to vote out Clarence. Nowadays, this sort of thing is completely standard, voting out your strongest member when you can still maintain a majority. But back then, when alliances had just been fairly rigid until that point, it was unthought of.
Yeah, that's right. And, for those of you who, it's been 10 years since this season aired, I'm sure most of you who watched it remember Lex, Ethan, and Big Tom. And those, Lex was really, at the time, you know, Ethan went on to win. Lex was the one really, for the most part, making most of the decisions about who went. And I think that's important to note, and keep that in mind, later on.
Right. He was the strategic driving force of the season. And that comes into play now at the final 9 as well, when he realizes that previous tribal council and council voted out, two votes were passed against him, obviously Clarence's, and then he has no idea who the second vote is.
Just for a bit of history, sorry. The way the final ten, the merge in Survivor Africa, they started with 16. The challenge, I believe, was the one where you hold your arm up and it's attached to a water bucket. It came down to two people, Clarence, who was the target to go home at final 10, and Teresa. And they'd been up there for like 6 hours. And neither of them wanted to come down. Teresa was singing. Clarence knew he needed to win to stay in the game. They decided to just cut to the chase. The two of them did a rock, paper, scissors. Teresa won. Clarence had to pull his bucket down. And then the way it worked is Teresa felt bad about, she knew Clarence was going to go. He was eliminated by a vote of 8-2. That second vote was for Lex. Clarence voted for Lex and another vote went to Lex. And that's the setup for the final 9 situation, which is Lex is now paranoid about who that second vote was.
And he eventually decides that the second vote was cast by Kelly, who he knows resisted his leadership for a long time. He tries to get Brian together to vote out Kelly. So at this point, he needs to find a fifth vote somehow. The way he goes about doing that is he calls in Brandon from the other tribe and wants him to vote out Kelly. So Brandon is in an interesting spot at this point, because he can join up with Boran effectively and vote off Kelly, or he can out Lex's betrayal of Kelly to Kelly herself and then get her to flip over to Sambu. So effectively he is the swing vote. He decides who will have the majority going forward in the game.
And just to kind of note, we mentioned briefly, but it should be worth reiterating, Lex's tribe, Boran, came into this merge up 6-4. By booting Clarence, they're now up 5-4. And now with this plan to boot Kelly, they would then go down to 4-4. It would become even numbers, Boran versus Sambu.
And an important thing to remember is that in Survivor Africa, as in the first few seasons, the tiebreaker rule wasn't purple rock draw, it was pass votes. So if I have 4 votes and Boran has 4 votes, and I had more votes cast against me in previous tribal councils, I'd be the one to go home.
We saw this come up. A very memorable tribal council was the merge in Survivor Australia. The way it ended up going is, they went in 5-5. One tribe, Ogacore, had two people, both Keith and Jerry, with previous votes on them. So when they went into the merge 5-5, if the other tribe, Kucha, correctly picked to vote for either Jerry or Keith, and it was a 5-5 tie, Ogacore would automatically lose because either Jerry or Keith had more previous votes on them than anyone on the other Kucha tribe that I remember.
So you can see that the past votes will affect strategy in quite a big way, and this comes into play again here in this situation, because
that's right.
Brandon knows that no matter what he decides, at the final 8, he's effectively the swing vote again, because he knows that past votes are being cast against various people on both tribes, and so if he gets whichever alliance is in to vote a certain way, he knows that he'll still have the majority and there won't be a tie. So he comes up with this plan to vote off Kelly at the final 9 and then flip back to Sambu at the final 8, because he knows that their votes are going against Lex. So Lex will have more pass votes than anyone on Sambu. So Lex will be voted out because of time.
It's worth noting, Lex has a boatload of previous votes on him, especially when Brandon flips. He knows Lex is going to get 4 more. So even when Brandon votes with Lex, at least Lex's past votes tally is getting higher and higher, to the point where no one, if Lex is involved in a tie, he's the one who goes.
Yeah, and he knows that Big Thomas will see votes previously as well. So yeah. Even if Lex wins immunity somehow, he's still able to follow through with his plan.
Yeah.
So he decides to go after Kelly because he thinks that if he gets to the flip, obviously he'd gain the majority. Sambu presumably would have gone Boran and the final five would be four from Sandru plus Kevin.
Yeah.
His worry is that, in this situation, his closest ally, who's Kim Powers, will eventually become closer to Kelly than she is to him. And then Kelly will be the one with the most power in the endgame and not Brand. Now, I think, obviously that's plausible, but it just, the argument doesn't really make sense to me, because in the endgame, Kelly effectively is going to have to choose between sticking with Frank and Teresa, who she knows are a tight couple and who will team each other for the final two, if they're in the final three together, or sticking with Brandon, who's going to be less popular with Drew, and both of whom he's going to be able to manipulate more easily because they don't have that same type of bond.
Now, back in this era of Survivor, five is a very, very powerful number in terms of a voting block. Because once you hit the merge, it means worst case scenario is a tie. They never merged at 12. They used to merge at 10. You're going to get a tie. Within five, you can then have, if your five makes final five, if you're then part of a group of three within there, you then have the majority to pick off the other two. And then if you're part of a group within two, I'm spacing now on who said, who made the onion analogy, in a previous season.
Gabon, I think.
That's right. It was, in Gabon, where he and Charlie were the inside layer of this onion. And more and more, as the onion got wider and wider, more people would be voting with them, but they already knew ahead of time how they were going to cut them down. And when you have five people in Survivor back then, that's really powerful, especially if you're the one on the inside of the onion, I guess, as it were.
Well, I think Brandon is justified in worrying that Kelly is a variable he doesn't want to have to deal with, because she's a smart player. Having her in the endgame and having her be powerful then is a legitimate concern for him. The problem is that he already knows that Kelly doesn't like Frank, and so on an emotional level, she's not really wanting to stick with him. And on a strategic level, it doesn't make sense for her either. I think the situation itself is pretty clear cut. I think Brandon's decision to vote off Kelly is perfectly defensible. The trouble is that he fails to execute his plan properly because he doesn't tell Sandru that he's doing it. When they get back to camp after the final nine vote, they think he's just flipped completely and betrayed them. And especially his closest ally, Kim Powers, saw was completely betrayed.
That's exactly right. And, that was probably an oversight on Brandon's part,
yeah,
to at least not let
it lie.
I would say that was definitely, considering, spoiler alert, how it turned out, I would say that was definitely an oversight. And in Brandon's defense, I like that plan to pile on votes on Lex, because you know it's going to be 4-4 if they, assuming he's operating under the assumption that Samburu is going to want him back, because otherwise logic would indicate that they're just going to get picked off one by one if they don't work together. What he didn't count on is that final eight, when, now that he's piled up all these votes on Lex that are going to break his final eight tie and Samburu's going to take the lead again, Lex wins immunity.
Right. And his plan accommodates for this in some ways, because he may be pile votes on somebody else who he might suspect has pile votes. But it makes it a lot easier for someone like Lex to organize a coup against Brandon if he wants.
That's exactly right. He's just, without warning anyone on his tribe, he's flipped over. As pure as his intentions may have been to take his whole tribe to the final four, they didn't know that. Apparently he didn't do a great job selling that point. We get to final eight, Lex wins immunity, and suddenly Brandon's the low man on the totem pole because he's kind of screwed over even his own people, and the Boran people are just happy to see a Samburu go.
Right. We agree that his execution was very poor.
Certainly. But that said, I think, I can at least get behind his mentality. I kind of like it.
So he knows that he's going to be the pivotal vote at the final nine and the final eight. So let's assume that he tells Sambu about his plan, they go along with it, and they don't vote him out at the final eight. So presumably okay. The rest of Boran gets Bogon, Ethan first, then Tom, presumably, after Lex goes. So the final five is automatically going to be four Sambu plus former Boran. He has to decide who he wants that former Boran to be. Now the way I look at it, Kelly is the best one for him to have there. Because she can team up, she's more likely to team up with Brandon and Kim Powers than any of the other four Borans.
That's exactly right. And I'm sorry for cutting you off. I think he does end up going with, if his dream comes true, I think he probably wants Kelly sitting there for that, exactly that reason. I think she has a much, much easier time relating to Brandon and Kim Powers than she does to, while she may like Teresa, I don't see her siding with Frank under any circumstances.
Yeah. You could argue that no matter who the Boran was, Brandon could get around that problem by going to Frank and offering a final four deal with Thor Sandu, which he presumably would have gone along with, and which, given his character, he would have wanted to stick to.
So, verdict on Brandon, you like it, you dislike it, things he should have done differently?
I understand his mentality, like you said. Ultimately, his execution was very poor, and he was in a very good position to start with, and he managed to punt that away in the space of one over there.
Yeah, I think I admire his ambition, his execution. Had it been better, I don't know that he wins, but maybe a Samburu wins. Probably, if a Samburu wins, it's probably Teresa or Kim Howard. I don't know that Brandon can win, but I do admire his ambition. And it really was really the first big flip in Survivor history, because up until that point, this is only season 3. This is 10 years ago. Season 1 and 2, a powerful alliance just took the numbers post-merge at with 9 left and just picked everyone off. And this was a really interesting post-merge.
Right, because of Brandon. That's why this was so historically significant. I think, even though you could maybe argue that it's not comparable to situations like Falcon's Flip or whatever, it's still important because it illustrates some basic points about flipping. You need to have a plan of how you're going to deal with the people who you flip away from as well as people you're going to flip to. It's worth pointing out just how much the past virtual changes have been out, because suppose the traditional tiebreaker rules in place and Brandon flips over. He votes out Kelly. Now, he's pretty much forced to stick beforehand, because if he flips back, it's just going to be a tie, they draw a rot. He wants to avoid that situation. And because Samburu know that he can't flip back anymore, this is seen as the ultimate betrayal.
Right? That's right.
So he automatically throws away their jury vote, even if he does make it again. This way, with his fairly inventive plan, didn't Samburu know that he can come back to them? It's not seen as such a heinous act.
Yeah, and I think it is, you know, we tend to agree a lot. This is an issue that we do disagree on. I don't think past votes should be or ever should have been a tiebreaker, and I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that you liked it.
Yeah, I do. I think it's pretty bad for the show in that it's not very dramatic. It's difficult for viewers to keep track of past votes. So, you know, if you're watching the merge episode and there's a tie and you haven't been following the season closely, all of a sudden it's decided by some votes that you hadn't even seen past 4 episodes ago, and it's a bit anticlimactic.
Yeah, there's certainly that. I'm sorry.
I think it does make the game itself better, and here's what. I think it creates an interesting dynamic where you have to plan ahead. Let's say it's pre-merge, and the whole tribe agrees you're going to vote somebody out. That person still gets a vote, and that vote potentially could be very important later on in the game. So each person, no matter how much they dislike the person they're going to vote out, has to at least work on getting that person to like and respect them enough.
Yeah, I agree, but I disagree, I should say. I agree that that's one way to look at it. I think it encourages much more passive gameplay, and as a viewer, that's not really what I'm interested in. And I'll explain why. I think you're going to get a lot more spite votes from early boots towards the people that were the ones orchestrating their elimination. For instance, Kimmy voting for Jeff Varner in season 2. And not that Jeff was solely responsible for Kimmy going, but that ended up obviously costing Jeff his game. And I would have liked to see a situation where a spite vote didn't cost someone their game and completely changed the course of the season.
So that's why the best and the most adaptable players run things from behind the scenes. If people know that you're responsible for their elimination, then of course they're going to, you know, try and work against you, probably vote against you. Part of being a good spider player is managing to avoid that set.
That's totally fair. And that's, we're going to see a lot more players like, I would say the average Survivor player tends to take that approach, which is the less aggressive, stay out of the limelight early approach. And I think, obviously, the more interesting people are going to be the ones that try to take the bull by the horns, I guess. And I think to punish them for trying to set up a good game early, I there's justification. I don't know. I don't like putting that much power in the hands of people getting voted out.
I think it does reward active gameplay, though, because you have to be prepared to stack votes on people in advance in the case of a tie in your own tribe, pre-merge, or post-merge. So let's say you think you're going to go into the merge ties. You want to stack votes on somebody else in your alliance in case, in the event of a tie, so that you're not the one being targeted, they are. Right?
But how often do tribes have that much wiggle room with their pre-merge votes where they can afford to just kind of throw a couple away?
Well, this is why it creates an interesting dynamic, because each player has to think, is my vote going to be one that potentially could disrupt the plan that our alliance has agreed upon if I don't go along with it? It creates a very interesting leveling war where people have to think about, you know, where's my vote going to go and what effect is it going to have, rather than just, you know, towing the party line.
That's fair. Yeah, you know, I can certainly see arguments for it. I don't know that rocks is the solution. I don't know that doing fire is the solution. I don't know what else you could do. I just don't know that passive votes is my first choice, I guess, is what I would say.
Right. As we highlighted earlier, though, having the drawing rocks all in place makes it a lot less appealing for people to flip multiple times. And I think we agreed that as viewers, one of the things we want to see is unpredictable gameplay. We want to see constant reshuffle, if you want to see people flipping back and forth and doing lots of crazy things, that's a lot more difficult to do as a player if you know that you're potentially going to be drawing rocks if you get things wrong. Whereas with pass throws, you can engineer the situation so that you can flip back and forth and get the desired outcome every time you want. And obviously other players have to be aware of that and try and fight back.
Your point is well taken. There's certainly merit.
One other thing is I think it will play very nicely with idols as well. It creates a fun game where you know that somebody has the most votes in them, but their tribe knows that as well. So do they give the idol to that person? Do you type the person the second most votes instead? Yeah. It creates some situations like that.
By the time the hidden immunity idol was introduced into the game, the past votes as a tiebreaker were long since.
Right. Gone. I think it would be interesting if you were to have a season where the two coincide.
What was the first vote? What was the first season that didn't have past votes? I know Africa did.
Well, it's difficult to know exactly where it stopped. Obviously, in Marquesas at the Final Four, you had a situation where Pascal draws the purple rock.
Right.
But it's unclear whether that was designed specifically for the Final Four or when that decision was actually made to change it.
Yeah, tiebreakers have changed throughout Survivor. Now, the only time that you don't draw rocks, I believe as the rules are, is at Final Four. I think Final Four only is the fire challenge. Any other tie goes to rocks.
Well, it's interesting to know that we don't actually know what the tiebreaker is. Everyone assumes it's rocks because that's what it was the last time. But the threat of going to rocks has prevented a tie for the past 19 seasons.
That's true. Well, you know, Cochran pointed out on the show, we've only seen rocks once, and that's for damn good reason.
So you could argue that maybe it succeeded in that regard, in preventing ties, like forcing there to be a majority of every single vote.
Mm-hmm. I know, I'm sure the rocks are put in there to try to avoid ties at all costs. So are you good on Africa? Are you good with Brandon?
Yeah, that's fine. Okay, so the next situation we're going to cover is the final line in Marquesas. Colin, do you want to say that?
Sure. Once again, we merged with 10 people left. Only this time in Marquesas, one of the tribes had been really dominant pre-merge. And despite a tribal switch, the Row 2 tribe went into the merge up 7-3. And the first casualty of that 7-3 advantage was the now legendary Boston Rob, who on his first time playing in Marquesas went out in 10th. So now we're left with 9. And as we've discussed, 9 is a very important number. Now, Row 2 was a tribe that, as I mentioned, just absolutely decimated the Mara Amu tribe before the merge. And Row 2 at its core had 4 people. And probably the most notable of those 4 was the guy kind of running it, John. And with him he had Tammy, Zoe, and the general, Robert. And on the other end, you have these, with 9 left, you have the 3 remaining former Row 2 who were with those 4 for the entirety, or much of the, most of pre-merge. And that's Kathy, who we obviously later saw in All Stars, and then the couple of Nalia and Pascal, this young Mormon girl and this old judge from, I believe, Georgia. Question becomes, how is this Row 2-4 alliance going to pick off these other 5? Because it seems apparent to the viewer that these are going to be your final 4. It's just a matter of how the others get booted. And at Final 9, we happen upon a reward challenge that changes everything. It was the first instance of the famous, that they've repeated it now a couple times, the challenge where you answer a question. If you're right, you get to knock off someone's rope that's hanging up coconuts from a tree. Now, Row 2-4 had a decided lead at the start of this challenge, and their biggest threat from the other tribe, the one they wanted next, was Sean to go. I think it was the first round, Sean had all of his ropes chopped. He was out. Just as for future players, if you show up and that's the challenge they give you, you're not going to win immunity because the other people decide your fate. So Sean's the first one out of the challenge, followed, I believe, by Vesepia, the only remaining person from Mara Amu.
Yeah.
And then Kathy, who spent the entire time pre-merge at Row 2, is kind of this outcast, perhaps being treated poorly, perhaps reacting to her surroundings not as well as she could have. She's the next one to sit down. All 4 of the Row 2 main alliance are left, as well as Nalia and Pascal. They make quick work of Nalia and Pascal. The 4 of them remaining in the challenge, this core 4 that have been kind of deciding the game every move to this point, are now the 4 left, and they're all smirking and smiling at each other. For those of you not great with math, 5 people are now on the bench, 4 are in the challenge, 5 is more than 4. Those 5 banded together, turned on the other 4. Now, Dom, to bring you, I know I've been talking a bit, this challenge, do you think without this challenge that flip happens, first of all?
We don't really know because, obviously, back then we didn't have much access to super scenes, that sort of thing. I want to think that people like Nalini and Pastor were aware enough of their position that they would try and get something going anyway, but we don't really know for sure.
And for those of you who didn't, for whatever reason, didn't see the season and still want to listen to this, Nalea and Pascal were part. They were going to get 5 and 6 if the row 2-4 made it the final four. They were going to give Pascal and Nalea final 6. Apparently, not good enough for Pascal and Nalea. Now, this is an interesting flip, and the reason we included this, not just because it's interesting, this is the first multi-person flip where what was a 7-2 advantage now, but if for, in terms of tribal lines, it now becomes 5-4, and the tribal lines are blurred. And how do you, when there are blurred tribal lines post merge, what kind of skill set do you think really excels in those? Because I would argue, the blurrier the tribal lines, the better the great players are going to do.
Well, obviously, I mean, if you give the great players more room to play, they're going to be the ones best placed to exploit that. You consider people like Kathy and Aaliyah great players, is up for debate, I think. I mean, Kathy, you can maybe make an argument for.
Yeah, I mean, you know, not to put Aaliyah in a greatest of all time discussion, but Kathy, I would say, certainly arguable, is a good player, for sure. Anything else? This is interesting because while kind of a counterintuitive flip, it's a very logical flip. It made sense. It paid huge dividends for all of the people involved.
Yeah.
Row 2-4 kind of had this poetic downfall. It was great TV. I don't know how much there is to discuss because, not that it's not an interesting flip, because it certainly is, but either the way that season's going to play out is either these five are going to flip at Final Four, or those core Row 2-4 led by John are just going to take it to the bank. And I think...
This is a situation where it's interesting more for the novelty factor than because it's actually a difficult decision to make.
That's right. It's just a very notable flip. It's interesting. It's correct. I don't think there's any debate that it was correct for Pascal, Malia, and Kathy to flip.
But if you think about why it was correct, obviously because they're just going to be picked up one by one otherwise. Also because traditionally when you flip, one of the main worries is losing jury votes to Doomit at the end. Here, they knew they were going to have to go up against each other anyway, so that becomes less of a concern.
That's a great point. That's good. Anything else for Marquesas? It's kind of a brief one, but it's at least worth noting for sure.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you can't really do a discussion about it without including it, if only to mention it in passing.
I agree. So next, we're going to be taking these chronologically, and I'm going to try when we post this episode to go through, so if you want to skip around, so you can skip around to the seasons you've seen and not ruin the other seasons. And the next notable flip, we're skipping Rob Cesternino for the next podcast. As I mentioned during our off week, we're going to be reviewing famous Final Seven situations. And while Rob Cesternino is certainly one of the masters of flipping, we're going to save that for the Final Seven podcast and move on to Johnny Fairplay. I'm sorry, Johnny Fairplay was not a flip at an odd number, which is kind of interesting and kind of, it wasn't a flip at an odd number, and it also wasn't a flip along, it wasn't, they were deadlocked at tribal lines and someone flipped just to not have a tie. He flipped with the intention of getting Rupert out with Final Eight. So the way this has been set up, the Drake tribe did well early pre-merge. They were very tight early. The Morgan tribe was getting killed. However, the Morgan tribe pulls it back together. We now have the two outcasts. For those of you who haven't seen the season, two people who were voted out in the first six got to come back. Both of them are still around to the merge. We go in 5-5 in terms of original tribes, but one person, Lil, was really hurt by, and she was one of the returning players, was really hurt by how she was treated her first time around and really had it out for her previous tribe, the Morgan tribe. So with 10 left, Lil says, screw you guys, I'm going to go with Drake. And Andrew Savage, one of the leaders of the Morgan tribe, gets booted. Final 9, take out their big threat, the biggest Morgan threat, who at the time remaining was Ryan Opre. Rhino. I'm hoping I'm saying his last name correctly. And we're now left with 8 people. And we have this Drake core of Rupert, Krista, and the now legendary Sandra, who really seem loyal to each other, not going to break. And also on the Drake tribe, but perhaps now with different ideas, is another returning player, Burton, and the infamous Johnny Fairplay. The way this boot worked, Fairplay wanted Rupert gone with 8 people left. Rupert had a lot of power because he really controlled those 2 votes. Fairplay didn't like it. Fairplay wanted this to be his game. He saw the votes. He saw he could take down Rupert. He took his shot. He hit it. It resulted in one of the greatest all-time episodes, in my opinion, of Survivor. Dom, how do you think? What do you think his best move in setting that flip up was? And if you're fair play, how would you go about trying to get someone like Rupert out when you have eight people left and he seems like such a presence? And, you know, this could tie into Coach currently.
Well, it's kind of an interesting situation because it's one of the few cases in my mind where we have three distinct alliances. You have Remnants of Morgan, Remnants of Drake, and then the Outcasts who have joined up with Fairplay. So the Outcast plus Fairplay become this very powerful voting block that can switch between sides as they wish and take out whoever they want. I think voting out Andrew Savage and Ryan Oakley is clearly correct. Two biggest threats from the opposing alliance.
For sure.
And I think Rupert Boot was correct as well. The way they did it, I think, worked very well. You can maybe argue that they could have done it in the final seven instead, so they vote out Tirana at final eight and join up with Dara. But given how big of a community threat Rupert was perceived to be, I don't think you want to leave him in the game that long.
Yeah, you really have, considering the people left, the only one who could, if the challenge is at all about strength, Burton's really the only one who can give Rupert a run for his money, because Fairplay's, you know, professional wrestling aside, not going to do you a lot of good when you're up against a guy as big as Rupert and you're the size of Johnny Fairplay.
Right, as Sandra famously said, Fairplay is like a girl.
That's that's right. So we have this Rupert situation, and an interesting factor in this is Sandra, because the way Fairplay goes about this is he wants to get Lil, who kind of burned Andrew Savage and Rhino, in the sense that she didn't like how she was treated, she would happily voted them out. Fairplay now needs to try to get her to vote against Rupert. And Lil's a very, very emotional player. Everyone seems to like Rupert except Fairplay and the cool guys on Drake. But Sean's gone, Burton still there, and already voting against Rupert. Tawana and Dara are now in a minority where they don't really have much say about what they can do. So when someone like Fairplay or Burton comes to them and says, we're going to turn the tables on the guy Rupert that seems to be running this and walking away with this, you have to assume they're going to say yes. That said, that only gets you to 4-4. And that's why you got to bring in Lil. And in the episode, Lil clearly struggles with her decision. However, it was a decision, she ultimately obviously signs with Johnny Fairplay, votes out Rupert. It was a decision that didn't even need to be made in the first place, because some would argue the greatest player of all time, Sandra, no matter what decision Lil made, Sandra put herself in such a position that she would, that Rupert was going to go. She voted against Fairplay at the Tribal Council when the vote was clearly going to be between Rupert and I believe Dara. I believe Dara was instructed the whole day to act like she was going.
Right, and you could maybe argue that this is why it was correct to do it at the final eight, because now you don't have to rely on Lil's vote anymore. Between, you know, Dara and Tirana, and possibly Sandra if she's going to vote, you have enough votes to get out Rupert, whatever, no matter what Lil does.
That's right. If you survive the final eight vote with your majority, you're still going to have that majority in the final seven, and now they can get rid of Lil as a dependent, as someone they need to depend on.
Yeah. It's interesting to note that boosting Rupert at final eight sets up an interesting situation in final seven where Dara and Tawana can potentially join up with Sandra and Krista and team up against the Outcast plus Fairplay.
That's absolutely right.
And we see that almost happened in the actual episode where ultimately Sandra vetoes it and we see a Tirana boot instead. But you can maybe argue that this is kind of careless preparation on Fairplay's part and that maybe he wasn't anticipating this or maybe underestimated the chance that it might happen.
I think he thought that he had Tawana and Dara kind of in a corner where if he can solidify them at final eight, they're probably not the types that are going to want to branch away from that at final seven. Like, they have a good thing going at final eight. They now are in the majority. I can see him saying, anticipating them wanting to stay in that majority and lock up final four.
Right.
Although your point is absolutely fair, which is Tawana and Dara can now join up with the remnants of Drake, boot Fairplay, boot the Outcasts, go head-to-head with Rupert and Krista, but I don't think that's a great course of action for them.
Right, and maybe Fairplay was confident enough in his own abilities that he knew he'd be able to get around that somehow. I mean, in the actual show, what he did was he invented a lie about Tawana, told it to Sandra, and then Sandra didn't want to join up with Tawana anymore, and yeah, the rest is history.
Yeah, you know, if there's a guy in Survivor history who's going to overestimate his abilities to convince people, it's probably going to be Fair Play.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, you know, I thought it was a great episode, first of all.
Oh, definitely.
One is still, to this day, one of my favorite episodes, and not because I dislike Rupert that much. That can be saved for a different time, the Rupert factor. But first of all, above all, I think Fair Play, more so than maybe anyone ever on Survivor, understood that he was on a TV show and was making great TV. And I think it really kind of captivated the audience. And even though he was just a dick the whole time and he was drunk most of the time, but at least for me, I was rooting for him. I was rooting for big moves. I was happy with Fair Play. I totally see the logic in his move. I agree with everyone else going along with him. I don't know what Krista and Sandra were doing ever. Anything else to add about Fair Play?
Yeah, well, we can discuss later why we think Sandra is perhaps overrated as a player. The point about Fair Play being aware that he was on the TV show. I think it was the Survivor writer Mario Lanza who did an interview with Fair Play where Fair Play said that his goal was to go and rape reality television. And he did that with the whole... I mean, Dead Ground on the Light is still iconic. If you ask people who don't even watch the show anymore, one of the things they'll remember about it is the Dead Ground on the Light.
Yeah, I was... I would rank it among the greatest, if not the greatest moments in Survivor history. And for that, Fair Play, we thank you. So what do you think... Let's see. Anything you would have done differently in Fair Play or anyone else's shoes there?
No, you can argue that Burton punted pretty hard later at Final Five with the whole reward challenge situation, but that's not really under the remit of this discussion.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, Burton won a car. He took Fair Play on the reward with him. He left the other three girls to sit and conspire against him, and that was the end of Burton. So I think are we good to move on to the next one?
Yeah, that's it for Pearl Islands, I think.
All right, that's it for Pearl Islands. And next, skipping ahead to Survivor Cook Islands, we now arrive with Jonathan Penner.
Right.
And this is an interesting season. At this point, there are now 9 left. I believe they didn't... Okay, let's see. They didn't merge to 12. But anyway, the situation is, before the merge, there was a unique opportunity where anyone unsatisfied with their current tribe was able to step off the mat and join up with the other tribe. Right. One person exercised that opportunity, that person being Candace, who we now know from Heroes vs. Villains, and immediately after, Jonathan Penner followed her right off the mat, heading back over to his original tribe, leaving 4 people with the I2 tribe up against 8, I think, on Raro. Something like that.
Yeah.
Those 4 people, Yule, Ozzy, Becky, and Sundra, orchestrated this flip, Yule specifically, at Final 9. They get it down with 9 people left, and the Raro tribe, after a string of immunity losses, a tribal council twist, it's now 5-4. And it's become clear that Jonathan Penner is going to be the swing vote with 9 left. One factor in this season that was unique, or not I suppose, to 3 seasons, was the hidden immunity idol, as it was originally designed, was extraordinarily powerful.
Yeah.
The holder of the hidden immunity idol didn't have to play it before the votes were read. So anytime they ended up with the majority of the votes, they could just play it. They get a free pass. They have to give up the idol, but the person with the next number of votes goes home. The person who found that idol was Yule, and Yule was down 4-5. Penner himself is a gamer, and I think that's apparent to anyone who's met him. Or within the context of Survivor. He's there to play. He loves the game. Yule knows that. And Yule also knows how powerful this idol is. And I believe Penner had already stated, perhaps even on the season in front of everyone, if you want to be in the final 4, you got to get with the guy with that idol. So with 9 left, Yule reveals to everyone he has the idol in an attempt to get Penner to swing over. And Penner does. And they take out Nate. He flips on the condition that they're taking out Nate. What do you think of Penner's flip?
I don't think... You could argue that it destroyed his game and that he didn't have much of a game left to play to begin with. At best, he was going to be Final 2, Final 3. Go. If you think about Final 3 combos he could potentially win, you're drawing thin, basically. Maybe Becky and somebody else. But again, it would be very difficult for him to actually engineer a Final 3 like that.
Yeah, it's tough. I'm sorry. It's tough. That was a pretty young cast. And Penner was, you know, in his early 40s and couldn't really relate that well to everyone. And I think Penner honestly didn't really have much of a shot that season from the beginning. He's going to have a really hard time winning any jury vote. I think he's going to have an especially hard time winning that jury vote.
Well, especially given the fact that he mutinies originally.
True.
If he doesn't mutiny, you can maybe argue that things go differently. So let's say he sticks with Aitu. Reru goes to tribal council. They vote out whoever they vote out. Rebecca, Jenny, whoever. Mm-hmm. So we get to emerge, kind of stick with Aitu. Maybe when we get down to sort of final nine, final seven, if she tries to shake things up, up in the final three with Becky, Sandra, or whatever. The four of them have this, have such a tight bond, and Yul in particular did a very good job keeping them in check, that I don't think any of them ever would have turned on the rest of Aitu. I think if Penner
wanted
to get any further than final four, he would have had to flip, and doing that, he would have thrown away jury votes anyway.
Yeah, I think it's clear they never wanted to turn on each other. You know, maybe if Penner hadn't mutinied, he would have been part of that core. But even at, you know, you look ahead to the final five where Adam offers, I'll still go and you guys can flush out this hidden immunity idol from Yul, they wouldn't even do that. Like, they seem to have tremendous respect for each other because they've been in a really tough place, overcome a ton of adversity, and we're now in a great place. And I don't think they could have done that if they didn't have that kind of respect for each other. So when we want to look at Penner's move, do you agree with the statement that to make the final four of that of any season with such a strong idol, you need to be with the guy who has that idol?
Well, there are two approaches you can take. One is to do what Penner did, which is to join up with the guy with the idol. The second is you find a way to get around the idol until the point where it's not as effective anymore. So let's say the final nine, he votes out Becky along with the rest of Rhea. Then let's say he managed to dodge the idol again at final eight. You know, we're in the final seven where even if Yul does manage to use his idol effectively, he's still down in numbers. He's going to need to find the idol again or one of his allies is, and they're just going to get the gong anyway.
Yeah, sorry, and just to be clear, it's not even a matter of him using the idol effect. The idol plays itself at this point. If you have the majority of the votes and you have the idol, you're still safe, regardless of when you play it.
It's theoretically possible that he could give it to someone else to use, but when you have something that valuable, that's very unlikely, I think, even for a gamer like Yul who might be willing to do that in the right situation.
We'll get it. I suppose now we can talk about what happened next, which is we're now at 4-4. It becomes clear that the four Rero are not going to team back up together. They've kind of accepted their fate for some reason. Parvati, Adam, and Candace approach Yul saying, if you go and vote out Penner ahead of us, I will then vote for you in the final jury. This is a discussion Adam had with Yul,
yeah,
saying, we know we're going to get picked off one by one. As long as you take this guy who just screwed us out before we go out, you have my vote if you make it to the finals. And ultimately, I believe Adam said he would have voted for Ozzy if Yul hadn't taken Penner out. So anyway, Penner, you know, you could argue he got what was coming to him. I think he made a hell of a move. Because there's really not much else he could do. Honestly, he knows he's not going to win, I think. I think he knew very early on he wasn't going to win. I would like to hear what you... Go ahead, please tell me.
I think Penner's case illustrates two things. Firstly, when somebody knows that they're not going to win, they're going to go with people they like or respect. So you have to, if you're going to be a good survivor, you have to at least play the social game, even if it might seem irrelevant at that particular point, because you never know when it could come up.
Yeah.
Even beyond, you know, working for jury votes or whatever, you have to be able to do that to keep alliance members in place. And secondly, it illustrates the danger of flipping. I mean, one of the dangers is people think, well, yes, she was able to, you know, he or she was able to flip to us, but she's willing to do that, then they'll just do it again whenever it suits them. So you may as well remove that variable now, get them voted out, and maybe make a play for jury votes for the people on the other side. And we saw this later with Candace and Hero Citizens and Finch and Smith, and get onto those cases later.
Sure. Anything else in terms of Penner?
That's about it for me.
All right. Cool.
All right. So we're going to move on now to Hero Citizens and in particular JT's situation. We'll go into that in a bit more detail. We're then going to go into decisions by Sandra and Candace to attempt to flip at the final nine, and then we're going to return to look at John Finch's flip in Smough and then type into Cochran's decision. So let me give you a bit of background as usual. We were at the fourth tribal council, and here's the villains. From the beginning, Tom's alliance of Tom, Colby, and Stephanie has been on the outs. Sugar was a consensus first group, but then Stephanie left second, and it looks like either Tom or Colby, presumably Colby, maybe Tom if he doesn't pay the idol, is going to be picked off next. So we have a majority alliance of Amanda, Rupert, and James, and they're loosely aligned to Candice and Ceri, with Ceri being the one who's in charge of that group. On the other side, we have Tom and Colby, and we have JT, who is solidly in with the majority alliance, but is considering flipping. So normally, we just boot out Tom or Colby, whichever one you want, and we progress as normal. But it's complicated by the fact that Tom has found the hidden immunity. And this creates an excellent opportunity for an aggressive, forward-thinking player like JC, and he seizes this opportunity with open arms. So, since everyone's aware that Tom has the idol, they decide to split the votes, 3 and 3. So 3 votes for Tom, 3 votes for Colby. And JT's decision is whether he wants to flip over temporarily and use this window to take out whoever he wants. Okay, so JT realizes that Ceri is probably the biggest threat to him here. What he decides to do is he tells Tom to play the idol, given that he's one of the votes for Colby. So JT flips over, and Tom, Colby, and JT vote for Ceri. So now it's 2 votes for Colby, 3 votes for Tom, but he's used the idol, so there's a count for that, and 3 votes for Ceri, and Ceri goes home in one of the most surprising moves, but also one of the most interesting moves that we've seen recently. So let's get right into this. What do you think of JT's move and why?
I think JT's move was, I think you described it well, as forward thinking. I don't think there are many people who would leave a comfortable position where they're clearly the leader with people willing to vote, to follow their vote. I don't think many people would choose to leave that behind to flip over to the two people who are down 5-2 within a tribe. That said, Ceri Fields is an absolute animal at Survivor. Yeah. And any time that you can boot Ceri while improving your own position in the game is a move I can endorse, because I fear Ceri as a player. She's proven herself, at that point, she'd proven it twice, that she was capable of making it far in this game.
Yeah, I think there are very few players who JT would have wanted to flip over and vote out in that situation, but Ceri is definitely one of them, and for good reason.
Yeah, okay. Absolutely. So in that regard, I absolutely like it. Ceri has a way of getting in people's heads slowly but surely, to be certain. You know, you don't need to look far. I suppose a great example of that would be Eric giving up the Final Five immunity in what is widely regarded as one of the dumbest moves ever made, all because Ceri and Natalie just talked him into it when he was one challenge away from the Final Tribal Council, or so they thought, give it up until the Final Two. But anyway, Ceri, anytime you have an opportunity to take Ceri out, I know I said it bears repeating, probably take it, especially when it improves your position in the tribe.
Yeah, she's a very dangerous player, and that might be fine if you're on the same side as her, if you're someone like Amanda or James or whoever, but Ceri has JT in her sights at this point. She's shown that she's not afraid of targeting strong players pre-merge. She did it with Yaman and Micronesia, and she knows that if she's going to target anyone in that group, it should be JT, because Tom and Colby are the types who will stick with their tribe post-merge no matter what. Both JT is going to be more enterprising.
Absolutely. And I think another point that kind of works in JT's favor in terms of this move, is that JT and Tom Westman have a very special bond on that Heroes tribe. And that bond is that they both have 7-figure bank accounts, and everyone on the island knows it. And I think they did recognize early on that it's in both of our best interests to kind of get towards the end together. And while that ultimately didn't end up happening, I can at least appreciate it for JT saying, you know, even if this doesn't work out and my tribe backlashes, I still at least have Tom and Colby. While that may not be much now, they're going to have a really hard time voting any of us out, especially after James goes down with the leg, which I don't think it happened yet, but it happened shortly thereafter. They're going to have a real hard time voting those people out if they want to, assuming there's not going to be a tribe swap because the tribes are just called Heroes and Villains, and assuming the villains are all competent players when under the direction of Russell and Parvati, I think that's a very fair assumption, and Boston Rob, I think that's a very fair assumption. JT is setting himself up nicely to go into the merge, and at the same time, the people on JT's tribe, even after this flip, still really like him and look to him as a leader. And I think that just speaks to JT as a player, and as I've said several times, I'll make it a first time on this podcast, if I had to pick any survivor in history to play a random season against random opponents infinite times and just pick the survivor who's going to do the best the most number of times, I'm taking JT every time.
And that's a topic we definitely plan on getting into in more detail on later podcasts.
Absolutely.
JT's decision for me is a classic example of a risky play, but, well, a play which seems risky on the surface, but which is actually just very good. He takes out one of the biggest challenge liabilities in his tribe, for one thing, so he's more likely to make the merge. And once he does make the merge, he's more likely to win in the end if he can gain a majority industry, because now instead of competing for power with Ciri, he only has to manipulate people like Amanda and Rupert and James, people who he can get to do whatever he wants, as well as Tom and Colby, who he knows will be completely loyal to him.
Not to go too far off topic, I think JT, besides being really strong, really likable, having that southern drawl that people just for whatever reason connect to, I wish I had it. My voice is annoying, I know that. People hate me, it's fine. Anyway, JT in Heroes vs. Villains played, in my opinion, perhaps the most creative game ever between the Ciri boot and then further giving Russell that idol. Didn't work out, but I think that's a very creative move that has a non-zero chance of working out.
Oh, for sure. We can discuss the idol play at another time, but it's certainly defensive. This isn't JT just spazzing out and doing something stupid. This is him playing an entirely new game than he did in Top Team. He's thinking things through. He's making bold, aggressive plays, ones which, if they work, are going to put him in a very good position.
That's exactly right. And I think the same principle, not to get into it, the same principle where if it works with giving Russell that idol, it puts him in a great spot. So I think it's fair to say we both like JT's flip.
Yeah, definitely. It's important to distinguish between JT's flip and examples like John Fincher or Cochran flipping on their own drives. This isn't a situation where he's tossing away jury votes if he does this. Firstly, because it's pre-merge, there's more time between now and final tribal council, those wounds can heal. And secondly, because he's not betraying his tribe. He's taking out the person he feels is most threatening to him. That's all he's doing. He's screwing over people like Amanda indirectly, but he's not ruining their future in the game.
Yeah, that's an excellent point and definitely a distinction that should be made. Anything else on JT?
I think that covers it.
All right. So you want to set up Candace and Sandra? This is a great spot.
Oh, yeah, certainly. So we're at the final nine of Heroes vs. Villains after JT has just been eliminated by his own idol.
That's right.
The villains are nominally up 5-4. So we have Russell, Parvati, Daniel, and Jerry for the villains, Colby, Amanda, and Rupert for the heroes, and then Sandra and Candace who are in between and wavering a little. So Sandra has hated Russell since day one. She's wanted to get her out since then, both for emotional reasons and for strategic reasons. And she sees an opportunity to do this. But not to get Ross out directly, but to at least wreck his game.
Yeah.
At the same time, though, Candace is feeling uneasy about her position. She's in a minority. She doesn't even like the people who are her own tribe mates. And Russell is making a very convincing pitch to her and backing that up with the force of the idol.
And might I just add quickly, this is a phenomenal play by Russell to anticipate both Sandra having second thoughts, which obviously he knows how Sandra feels about him, but to anticipate, despite seeing that he's up 5-4 and knowing Sandra just doesn't care as long as it's not her, to kind of have this insurance policy, I think is a really underrated move.
Right, and I think he executes it in a fairly poor way, but to realize that and then to at least try and act on it is very important if we're in Russell's spot there.
I think much of what Russell does is a great idea, but executed poorly.
Yeah, I guess the way I put it is that he's a good tactician, but a very poor strategist. He can accomplish specific outcomes, but he doesn't have the ability to realize if those outcomes are actually beneficial.
That's it. Yeah, he can make happen what he wants to happen. That's a good point.
Right.
Okay.
So this is a more multi-layered case than any of the ones we discussed previously. So I think what I want to do is talk about each possible scenario. So we have, what happens if Sandra flips, what happens if she stays with the villains, similarly what happens if Candace flips, or what happens if she doesn't flip and lets Sandra come over. So let's talk about Sandra first. So if Sandra flips, she goes, joins up with Candace, they flip over to the heroes. She is nominally fitter than that alliance. I mean, she's joined it, but in reality, she's the tightest person, and she's got the closest bond to Candace. She has a pre-existing bond with Rupert that she can exploit if she wants. And she also has to deal with people like Amanda and Colby who aren't aggressive strategic players. So if she wants to manipulate them for her own purposes, she's going to be able to do that.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily call Sandra an aggressive strategical player. In this instance, I suppose she was. But generally speaking, she's pretty passive. But to speak to your point, certainly Amanda and, I'm sorry, Rupert were the other two that are not.
I would agree with that, but we're sort of imagining what would happen if she were an aggressive player and capable of thinking about things at this level.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what we do when we discuss hypotheticals. But similarly with Candice, I don't think Candice is capable of making these types of moves, but if she were, how would she go about it? And this is what we're interested in.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't mean to. Yeah, this is all obviously operating purely hypothetically, but it's certainly worth getting into, I think, which is the whole point of this podcast. That's what we're doing.
Right, so we have to consider what happens if Sandra Blitz doesn't flip, same thing with Candice. But also, once they make that decision, how are they going to go on from there? So in Sandra's case, let's say she flips. If she just goes and pogongs the villains with the rest of the heroes, she's in the final five with Amanda, Rupert, Candice, and Colby. From there, she's closest to Candice and Rupert, and she can manipulate Colby and Amanda. So her position in terms of getting to the final three is quite good. The question becomes, can she win once she gets there? If she flips, she pisses off the villains. Obviously, she wasn't going to get Russell's vote anyway,
mm-hmm.
but she loses possibly Parvati's vote, Jerry's vote, maybe Danielle's vote. And those votes could potentially be very crucial if she's up against someone like, you know, Amanda or Colby or whatever.
Yeah, an important thing to consider, given that tribes are roughly even going into the merge, and in this case they were dead even, is if you successfully pogong the other tribe and get yourself to the final three with your own alliance, that jury is now the majority, is the tribe that you just pogonged. And yeah. You now have to get them to vote for you. Which is why someone like Russell, who's aggressive, maybe insulting, demeaning towards the people that he's voting out, calling stupid sometimes to their face, does not a favorable jury make. But yeah. I think with someone like Sandra, the lack of aggression on her part, she's just kind of along for the ride, which, you know, there are merits and there are arguments against it. But at least I think she does well when she plays that way. Obviously, we've seen that she does well when she plays like that with a jury. However, in this hypothetical, she's forced to take a much more aggressive line. And I agree. I think I agree with you that I don't know how well she does in a jury taking this line.
So if they do get down to that final five, the problem is that Amanda is probably the biggest threat at that point, both in terms of jury votes and in challenge ability. So, ideally, Sandra should want to get Amanda out right then and there. But if she does that, when they get down to Final Four, it's doubtful whether Rupert would want to turn on Colby.
On Colby?
I think. So, potentially we could have a tie leading to a fire challenge, which Sandra certainly would lose, and Candice probably would as well.
I would pay money to watch Sandra start a fire.
So, if Sandra does flip, one other option is trying to organise a re-flip at Final Seven, potentially with Candice, who we're assuming is close to her at this point. So let's say they take out Parvati first, Final Nine, and then, say, Russell or Jerry. So then she and Candice flip over to join up with the two remaining villains. They vote out Amanda and Colby first, and they go into the Final Five. Here she's in an arguably better spot. I mean, she probably has a less tight bond with Rupert now that she's flipped back and, you know, betrayed him as he would see it. But she still has a tight bond with Candice, and she has additional jury goats in the form of Russell and Danielle, if they're still there.
So when Sandra takes this line of flipping at Final Nine, what do you think how do you think she fares? Like, do you think she can win often enough?
Again, I think it depends on whether she reflips at Final Seven. You can make arguments for and against it. It's interesting because when she reflips, she loses more jury votes, probably. But she's now in a position to get to the end with people who aren't going to pick up those extra jury votes anyway, in the form of Russell and Danielle.
Mm-hmm.
So even though she's downgraded herself in that sense, she's actually improving her position.
It takes kind of a creative mind to see that. And, you know, certainly you have that kind of mind. I don't know that the average Survivor player, especially given the conditions and how long they've been out there, is going to see that. And you're not to set Sandra up too much, but I certainly don't think Sandra's going to see that. I think Sandra's going to see, I can survive longer by doing this, thus I'm going to do this.
Right, and whatever you think about Sandra, by her own admission, she plays day to day. She plays emotionally. She decides on a course of action and goes through with it without really thinking about the consequences. And that can be fine sometimes in the short term, but in the long term, you have to be thinking more clearly.
Yeah, I agree. I think in both of Sandra's wins, I think she made big mistakes that ended up working out weirdly well for her. And I think this Final Nine thing is one of those mistakes.
Right, and it's arguably the same thing you saw with Hannah before. And arguably with Candace and Chris Hines the first time, where people feel ostracized by their tribe, so they make an emotional decision instead of a rational one. Now, obviously you criticize them for doing that, but you also have to criticize people who put them in that position in the first place. If you know someone's going to act emotionally, you stop them from being able to act emotionally. You don't enable that.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of, all of this is, I'm trying to think of how to put this. Okay, I at least for me, to view this as kind of like robots playing Survivor, where each is making the optimal move at all times, where it's kind of like a Nash equilibrium thing, where, and now this guy, I promise I'm going to relate this to Candace, where Sandra's move based on Candace's move, the two really tie in together, because if Sandra flips and Candace flips, then neither of their flips makes a difference.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting scenario from a game theory perspective, because let's say it's beneficial for both of them to flip. Now, if both of them flip, then they cancel each other out. So they each have to kind of convince the other to act against their own interests.
Whereas that's right.
If it's not in either of their interests to flip, then it's perfectly fine. But if it's in the interest of one of them to flip, then we have a whole new discussion and so on. So for Candace, now let's say she knows at this point that Sandra is thinking about flipping. Let's say she sticks with the heroes. Now, if, again, assuming you're going, they go to the final five, she's kind of in the same position as Sandra is, in the sense that they're both tightly aligned and they can team up the same people. But Sandra has a lot more freedom in that she's going to win more final three combinations.
Yeah.
But Candace is very limited in that regard.
Do you think there's a combination of heroes remaining post-merge that Candace can beat?
Frankly, I don't think there is. Maybe Rupert or Amanda if Amanda bombs again.
Well, that wouldn't be anything like Amanda Campbell to bomb a final tribal council.
Oh, no.
To answer my own question, I agree. I don't think Candace, I think she didn't have much of a shot, even from day one. I think it's going to be real hard for Candace to win that season, no matter what she does.
Yeah, if she sticks with the heroes, she's in a safer position in that she's fifth in that alliance and she's never going to get voted out, at least not until final five, final fours. But she has very little chance of actually winning the game. And if you're going to play to win, then you have to take risks which decrease your safety in order to increase your long-term evil.
I agree. And we're going to get to that same concept right after this when we talk about John Fincher, I think.
So assuming that Candace stays with the heroes, we discussed this now before, what if Sandra and Candace reach up to the final seven. Again, I think this is more beneficial for Candace than it is for Sandra, because Candace needs to be around people like Danielle and Russell if she's going to win the game. Sandra doesn't. And Sandra's putting herself in a very dangerous spot where she's the biggest jury threat in the game, and she can't win challenges. So if people realize that she's a jury threat, she's going to be taken, and she can't do anything about it.
Yeah, I concur. And I know we agreed, you know, perhaps too much in the first one. But really, I think when we sit down and analyze these spots, I think the goal generally is to come to a conclusion about what the better move was.
Right. So if we look at the alternatives, let's say Sandra sticks with the villains of Final 9. They vote out Amanda, as they did in the actual show, and then vote out her if they want, probably Rupert, whoever. Let's assume that there's a growing this time. So they vote out the remaining heroes. The final six then is Russell, Puffy, Daniel, Joey, Sandra, and Candace. Now, they know that Russell, Puffy, and Daniel have had a close alliance since the beginning, but that's not really a cause for concern here, because firstly, Joey is going to want to break up Puffy and Danielle, and Russell's as well. And it's entirely possible that people are going to want to vote Russell out to stop other people from taking him to the end as a jury.
That's a good, like the Courtney effect, Saru taking out Courtney in Exile Island, because she, by removing the person people were going to take and beat, she now becomes the person that people are going to try to take and beat. So we're left now with five villains and Candace. And what I'm seeing is Parvati and Russell and four people who probably aren't going to want to take an initiative on the move.
Yeah, that's what I'm seeing too.
Okay. So do you think it then becomes Russell and Parvati trying to get three of those four votes for themselves to boot the other person? Because I think Russell would probably be correct in trying to boot Parvati at Final Six in this situation. I don't think Parvati would be correct in trying to boot Russell, because I don't think he can ever win a jury.
I think they definitely need to challenge her at some point. Whether that point is Final Six, I think, is unclear. I mean, it could happen at Final Seven instead, maybe, with one remaining hero.
Who do you think that would be, by the way, just out of curiosity?
Either Colby or Rupert. In all honesty, given how dismal Colby was at challenges that season, it probably would be Colby.
I was thinking Colby as well.
Because if you leave Rupert in, he might well act irrationally, whereas I mean, Colby is not going to play a great game by any means, but he at least has this instinct for self-preservation. If you give a plan to him, he's going to go along with it.
Yeah. I think Colby, honestly, you know, in my, again, not to get off too much of a tangent, I think Colby made the worst move in Survivor history when he voted Keith instead of Tina out. And I think, honestly, he played a little bit, he seems to at least show some more ability with the nuances of the games in Heroes versus Villains that I didn't really see in Australia or All-Stars.
I think that's fair, yeah. So anyway.
But it may also have been circumstantial, because the number of times that Colby was on the chopping block and got saved, I don't know how many directly are because of things he did rather than just changes of plan.
Yeah, that's fair as well. So we're in a position where we agree that Russell and Pavlov want to turn on each other at some point.
Yeah.
I agree that it's probably not correct for Pavlov to want to beat Russell, if only because by this point, I think the only people she beats in a jury vote are Russell, Danielle, and Candice. If Russell leaves, obviously Danielle and Candice are still there, but I think she wants to have extra outs in case one of them leaves for whatever reason.
I see. Yeah, because when you boot one of your goats, you're playing with fire in terms of she's now only got two people left and she needs to get there with exactly those two.
Right. Whereas Russell, again, I think we would both say couldn't win the game anyway at this point. But if he is to win the game, it's probably against Danielle and Candice.
Yeah.
And if he wants to bring that about, he needs to separate Daniel and Pavlov, so that's an ideal time to do that.
Yeah, and that's why, what I said earlier, which is that I think Russell would be correct in targeting Parvati. I don't think she would be correct in targeting him at Final Six, just because she can beat him. And I was honestly surprised. You know, Parvati not winning that season, better juries, say whatever you want to say. I was kind of surprised by that. I would have thought Parvati as a former winner, who won very differently than Sandra won, I would have thought a jury of All-Stars would have more respect for that in terms of her getting back to the finals again despite playing such an openly bold, aggressive, and everyone on the season didn't get to see Russell play in Samoa. They did get to see Parvati play in Micronesia.
Well, I think the full assumption there is that because it's a jury of All-Stars that they're going to be more objective. I think they're going to be more emotional, if anything, because think about it. If you take a group of people, invite them back to Survivor, which is an ego-boosting thing in itself, you call them heroes, and then you have them be humiliated by some of the greatest players of all time. They're not going to take that very well. I mean, these are egotistical people who have just been embarrassed on national TV.
Yeah, that's totally fair. You know, we've seen historically all-star juries perhaps not picking the right person to win. You know, that's a good point. I see your point. So any other Candice flip situations that we need to get to?
I think that's everything for Sandra and Candice. So we can move on to Fincher if you want.
Sure. All right. Now, Fincher, when we were sitting down talking about which flips to go over, Fincher was the one that I think we both agree is the most similar to what we've seen from Cochran this season, which is to say Fincher's flip was tribe against tribe, almost, or very close to it. And as a little background, this is Survivor 19. We've gone a little out of order, but that's fine. This is Survivor 19, and this is, as you may know it better, this is Russell Hance's first season, because he was really about 75% of that season in terms of strategy and airtime. So anyway, this is a season where we merge at 12. And going into this merge, Russell has Jason, Mick, and Natalie White, and they were the former Foa Foa, and they are facing a daunting task, because they are up against 8 people from the other tribe. And it is going to be a tall order for those 8. Or for those 4 to get through those 8. But anyway, when you are dealing with a numbers advantage that big, Galoo failed to resist their temptation to just get rid of someone from their own tribe because, you know, they can get rid of whoever they want and still be up 7-4. They do choose to do that, and Eric goes with an idol in his pocket. Very quickly, this isn't what we're talking about. Do you like that boot, the Eric boot?
I like it if they're going to play optimally after that point, but...
Optimally is not a word I would use to describe how they played after that point.
Well, quite, yeah. I think John himself said it best, which was that Blue, if you remember, had only been to a few tribal councils pre-merge. The one where they voted out Yasmin and the one where they didn't have to vote at all because Russell Swan was medevac. So they didn't have much experience actually playing the game, having to scramble for votes, having to come up with a sensible plan. So the moment that somebody like Natalie or Jason or Russell came up to them and offered them an idea, they sort of jumped on it like children and went along with it. And it could have been anything, I think, and they just would have complied without really thinking.
Yeah, I think the same thing could be said for the Karor tribe in Palau, where they didn't get to do anything pre-merge. They went to tribal council once, and by the time the merge hit, everyone was really eager to start knocking people off.
Yeah, and that's why it was so easy for a player like Tom to just run over them, because while everyone else was just not focusing on the game at all, he knew what had to be done and put himself in a position to do it.
Anything else before I continue on with catching people up on the situation?
No, go ahead.
Okay, so we're now down to 11, and the Galoot tribe is up 7-4. At the next tribal council, Russell plays his hidden immunity idol. All of the votes against him are gone. The Galoot tribe had gone in trying to get him out. All the votes against him don't count, and he sends Kelly out. So now Galoot is up 6-4, and here we enter the point of interest. Now, when you're dealing with Galoot, you're dealing with a lot of different people, and perhaps most notably among those people are Laura and Dave Ball, who are kind of the de facto leaders of the Galoot tribe, but also rubbing Shambo the wrong way. Shambo's been, feels like she's been mistreated almost throughout, and she's ready to turn, she does not care for Laura, does not care for Dave Ball. She's ready to go with Russell. She's ready to go with Natalie, Jason, and Mick. She's ready to switch it up and try to give herself a chance. So now, Shambo's committed with 10 people left. She tells Russell, I'm with you guys. That's 5-5. Galoot is now, so now Galoot consists of 5 people, effectively. Laura, Dave Ball, John Fincher, who we're going to get to in a minute, Brett, and Monica Padilla. So it's now, the first vote happens with 10 people left. It's 5-5. It's a split. John Fincher, who I believe, who was not overly well-liked by the Galoot tribe, opts to switch, vote with Foa Foa and Shambo after the 5-5 tie, switch things up, and now that 8-4 lead going into the merge has now kind of, has become a 6-4 deficit with Shambo and John Fincher now kind of joining up with Foa Foa. So I want to start at Final 10. First of all, if you're John Fincher, on the first vote, I assume you're going to vote with Galoot.
Yeah.
The second vote, what's going through your, what are the pros and cons of flipping? Why, if you're John, if you're in John's shoes, what are you thinking?
I'm thinking that I don't really have a combination of people from Galoot that I want to play the game with and that I want to take to the end. Because I know that I'm going to go up against a jury which is going to be majority Galoot no matter what happens, given the imbalance between the two tribes.
Right, yeah.
And if I'm on the outside of Galoot, then obviously I don't want that to happen. So I want to at least play the game with some people on FOFO, whether it be Russell, Jason, Mick, whoever. And potentially all of those people are going to be vulnerable if it comes down to drawing rocks.
That's right. And that's a good point, is were John Fincher to not flip, we see rocks. And it would have been the first time in a long time. Now, I was listening to John Fincher earlier today on Rob as a podcast. I saw Rob brought him in to talk about flipping, obviously, after the Cochran thing. As new podcasters, we have no such, and not as former survivors, we have no such luxury. But he mentioned in that his final plan actually was to really blur up tribe lines, reflip, and try to, his ideal final three was against Monica and Jason. So my question is, do you think that's a realistic final three in terms of how, logistically, do you think he can make that happen? And secondly, do you think he wins if that's the final three? I'm sure that'll change depending on how it happens. But do you think he's drawing live no matter what, I guess?
Taking that in reverse order, I can see why he wouldn't go to the end of Monica, given that she was probably the least popular Galoot after him, if we're counting Shambo as a photo of her.
As photo of her, yeah.
Even so, though, I think Monica gets Laura and Kelly for sure, probably Brett as well. And I think, I mean, she's a law student, I think she could put in a pretty good tribal council performance. Similarly with Jason, I mean, again, you could argue that maybe he hadn't done much during the game. He was just kind of there. He wasn't really responsible for any big moves. He didn't win many challenges. Even so, why would you want to go up against him instead of someone like Shambo or Russell, who just doesn't really make much sense?
Yeah, I think given the makeup of his tribe, John Fincher was in a really, really hard spot. That said, I do like the flip.
I think he might be assuming that since he views Russell's gameplay as so formidable and so deserving of winning a vote, that everyone else might think that as well. Kind of classic error of thinking that everyone's going to act and think in the same way as you do. Whereas if he looks at the situation differently, he might realise that, well, actually, these people hate Russell and these are emotional people. They're not here to play the game, they're here to make friends.
Yeah, I think John Fincher's obviously a really smart guy. He's a rocket scientist.
Oh, yeah.
What really surprised me was that he didn't want to sit next to Russell at the end. Because you know, maybe the perception of Russell out on the island wasn't as bad as the editors made it seem, or really, or more realistically, I think John was just out of touch with Galoo. Yeah. And I don't know, like you said it, about All-Star juries, I think Galoo is the same way in the sense that I feel like all of them had the egos of All-Stars, and the egos of people who feel like they deserve to be there, should be winning. And I don't think they're going to handle losing well when you have people like Laura in specific, or Monica, I don't even see being a very gracious loser.
Right.
And I think when you have someone like Russell out there, who even when they were tribe versus tribe was kind of fair, Johnny Fairplay-ish in his demonstrations at challenges or interactions with the other tribe, that he was kind of an off-putting guy. And while he got results and got things done, not really maybe not the easiest guy to get along with, certainly not the easiest guy to be in an alliance with, and a very hard guy to be against. I don't know why, when you're faced with a jury that I feel like Fincher would know well enough, would take things personally, that he wouldn't want to be next to Russell.
Yeah, I agree. If you think about who was eligible to draw Ross at that point, I believe it was Mick who won immunity that round.
That's correct.
So the vote comes down, five for Laura, five for Natalie. Let's say he maintains it. So the people who could draw Ross are, from Galoo, it's him, John Fincher, Dave Ball, Monica, and Brett. And from Furfo, it's Russell, Jason, and Natalie's immune because she's target for both.
And so, yeah, right.
And of course, Shambo's eligible as well.
Yeah.
So he wants to work with Shambo. Shambo likes him. Shambo's loyal to him. Shambo will do whatever he wants, and he can easily beat her in a jury vote. Right? Trivially easy to do that. So he doesn't want her to leave. He doesn't want Russell to leave either, for the same reasons. He thinks he can play the game with him, and he wants to drag him to the end to win a jury vote. What about someone like Monica? He doesn't really care whether Monica stays or goes. Probably better for him if she goes, even though he seems to think otherwise. Probably the same as someone like Dave Ball or Brett, so on. But if you asked him who he wants gone the most, he'd probably say Laura. Right? She's the leader of the alliance, which he's normally on the outside of. So given that she's a person who would go home if he flipped, then it seems like it's an easy decision then. Because not only does he avoid possibility of drawing rocks altogether, he also takes out the one person he would want gone if he just had sole freedom to choose.
Yeah, that's very, very well said, and that's why I'm glad you're doing this podcast with me. Because that's, you know, I imagine with someone like John that kind of thing was going through his head, and that's, you know, part of the reason why I further agree. I think Laura would be his best target to vote out, and I think for all those reasons you just laid out, that this flip is great.
Right, I'm just echoing the reasons that John himself gave on one of his earlier appearances on Rob Has a Podcast, but you can see that he was thinking about the situation very coldly, very rationally, whereas someone like Cochran, I'd argue, is just making a decision based on personal reasons and not on strategic ones.
Yeah, and first of all, anything else to add about John Fincher?
I'd say that his ideal Final Three scenario, just like everyone else's ideal Final Three scenario, would be with Russell and Shambo.
Yeah.
So, firstly, he wants to make sure that they don't draw rocks because they could go home. And also, if Galoo gains the majority again, then they're probably going to be voted out soon anyway, which is another reason why there's another case in which his ideal jury goes to go home. So he doesn't want that to happen. So it seems like there are multiple reasons all pointing to the same conclusion, which is jump ship and don't pull rocks.
Absolutely. And I think now is a good time to start the juxtaposition against Cochran, because these are very similar situations. But the reason, you know, part of the reason John Fincher flipped is because drawing rocks most of the time would be bad for him in terms of who goes is a step down versus him flipping. Whereas with Cochran, we've gone over the math, or we've gone over the situations on the thread. Cochran's got a 5 out of 7 chance of a new Polu going, which puts him in a great position.
Yeah, and even if you ignore the possibility of that person in each case, Fincher or Cochran drawing rocks, the main motivation behind the decision should be what happens if other people draw rocks, given that that's more likely.
Correct. Yeah, so are you ready? Are you good to go into Cochran?
Yeah, that's good for me.
All right, cool. So we're going to go back now to the final 12, the infamous flip from Cochran that really decided the direction that this game was going to go. So Cochran flips at final 12, and I think the way we should do this is to go through what happens in each of the three situations, which is what we did, which is kind of how I think both of us approached it on the thread on 2+2. And I think it's the correct way to approach this, which is there are three different outcomes, really, for Cochran when he draws a rock. One is that he himself draws the rock, gets sent to Redemption Island, he's done, he's not going to win on Redemption Island, it's over. because of immunities, the only other because of the necklaces and hidden immunity idols, the only other person from Savai who can draw a rock is Jim. We'll go over that, and we'll also go over what happens with when a new Polu draws a rock. So, Dom, where do you want to start?
Well, obviously, we can kind of discount the scenario where Cogman draws a rock because it's game over. And when we say we don't like his move, we acknowledge that that's a possibility, but we just think that that danger is outweighed by the benefits of staying true and not and drawing rocks.
That's right. And you know, I typed out a formula in terms of this. Whatever you feel, you can play along at home. I guess I can post this on the blog. Whatever you feel Cochran's chances would be based on who pulls each rock, like whatever percentage of equity you would assign him based on each different rock pull, you can kind of put together into this formula and I think come to the conclusion that no matter who pulls the rock other than him, which is only 14%, there are seven people drawing. One out of seven times he pulls the rock, that's 14%, assuming it's a fair draw, which I'm assuming it is. But six out of the seven times, I would argue, when he doesn't pull the rock, his game improves substantially. And the easiest way to look at it is, first of all, five out of the seven times, it's going to be an Apollo gone, which gives Savai the numbers up 6-5. Now, the argument people make against that is that Cochran was clearly the next one to go. Would Savai have had to go to another tribal council? But I think post-merge, that really changes. And I think if they do successfully pagong the other tribe and get down to just the sixth Savai, the Cochran, well, I don't think he goes out in sixth almost ever. I think he's in a great spot.
Well, the argument is that he's in the same position post-merge as he was pre-merge, but that's just not realistic because pre-merge, the only reason he was being targeted is because of his poor performance and challenges. Whereas post-merge, the inverse is true. You're rewarded essentially for your poor performance and challenges because it's not the reason to get you out.
I think at the same time, if you look at those six Savai who would theoretically be getting down to the end, it seems to me you've got Ozzy, Keith, and Whitney against Jim, Don, and Cochran, and it looks like it's going to be 3-3. But I would say if they cut the pagonging off early and leave a seventh, that Jim, Don, and Cochran are far more likely to bring someone in to take out Ozzy, Keith, and Whitney than the other three are to pull in a fourth to eliminate Jim, Don, and Cochran.
And also you have to consider that nobody wants to go to the final four with a tight pair like Keith and Whitney because they're almost automatically going to force a tie. People are going to want to bust up that pair before you get to final four, so final five, final six, whatever.
Yeah, and I think another thing is when you're at the merge and you're up in numbers by enough of a margin, it's never hard to get the people that are down in numbers to wait a vote and just take Ozzy out. Anytime Ozzy doesn't have immunity, I think it's really easy to sell Ozzy as the boot. You maintain your numbers, and you're now in a great position to kind of take the initiative with your choice of Don, Jim, and whichever Apollo is still left. So the main criticism I have of Cochran's flip is that by flipping, in my opinion, he reduces his chances of winning the game to next to nothing.
Right. So you just got the situation where an opponent member draws a rock, which is going to happen about. So obviously the other options are he draws a rock or Jim draws a rock. If Jim draws a rock, he's basically, I'd argue, in a better position than if he flips, because he knows that he's flipping to a lower group anyway. He knows that no matter what happens, if Upolu gets a majority, he's probably going to be the last Savai standing, just because he's not going to win immunity anyway.
That's right.
So if Jim draws a rock, he's in the same position as if he flips, but he's more likely to retain the jury votes of people like Ozzy and Keith and Whitney if he does somehow manage to get to the end.
That's fair, and and I think Cochran's motivation primarily in not flipping, he's been a huge fan of this show for a really, really long time, as have I, and I presumably you as well. But anyway, I don't think he wanted there to be any shot he said as much, that he didn't want there to be any shot that he goes home because of random chance. He wants to take his fate into his own hands. He doesn't want to go out like that. But my question for you and for him is, at what cost are you willing to stay in the game? Because as far as I see it, to stay in the game, you've taken yourself out of the running.
Right. I can see his logic if you're assigning some kind of non-monetary value to the experience of being in the game for longer. And if you're a fat, big fan like he is, I can understand that. The problem is that I think both outcomes, him drawing the rock and him flipping to a Apollo, both lead to him losing. But it's difficult to look at it like that because the payoff in the event that he flips to Apollo is delayed because he might lose at final seven or whatever. Whereas when he draws the purple rock, the effect is immediate and obvious.
Yeah. Another thing, what do you think his odds of winning were he to not flip, roughly, if you in a vacuum?
Okay, well, not taking into account the possibility of him joining the Rock or whatever. Once he survives that vote, and it's the six of them, and they go further into the game. Firstly, I think Whitney never wins in any situation. I think she's drawing dead. I think Ozzy has to go on an incredible run to even make the final 12 of council, let alone win once he gets there. And similarly with Dawn, I mean, nobody wants to take Dawn to the end, and she's going to have to win challenges in the late game to do that. So given the right combination of immunity wins, I think Jim or Cochran wins most of the time. I think Jim wins slightly more often than Cochran does, but Cochran still has, you know, a lot of that too.
Yeah, I agree. I think if Cochran's does not flip and Upolu draws the rock, as they would do 5 out of 7 times, Cochran's, I would say Jim is the favorite by actually probably a bigger margin. I think Jim wins a ton when Upolu draws the rock. I think Cochran is the second most. I think Don and Ozzy are drawing live, but it's hard for them to get there, and I think both Keith and Whitney are dead. So really, by staying true, I think he makes it, he really increases his odds versus he's risking potentially going home that night, but he's putting that up against, in terms of equity, so much. And the argument that I see some people make on the forums is that, not necessarily an argument to justify the flip, but just something that may have been going through his mind, is that he wants to get asked back to play again. And I know I've told you this before. The first, were I ever to appear on a show, I'd be playing the first time to get asked back. Because once you start establishing yourself as a returning player, they'll bring you back 4 times, just ask Boston Rob. So do you think that contributed into it? Or do you really think it was just fear, lack of clear thinking? What do you think it was? Why do you think he flipped?
I don't know if that specifically was his goal, but he definitely wants to make a name for himself. I mean, this is something which he's been obsessed with for a significant portion of his life, and he wants to make the most of that experience. And if the way he thinks he can do that is to, you know, become remembered as the guy who made this massive move, then so be it, I suppose.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've never heard it phrased that way, that he spent such a portion of his life, because Cochran's my age, and I'm assuming we've been fans for the same amount of time. And I'd like to think that if I was in his spot, that there would be no way I would flip, because I would hopefully be able to assess the situation as well as we can from here within Savai, which I think is reasonable. And 86%, given the 14% I'm dead, 86% sounds really good to me. If that 86% holds up, I've got a great shot to win.
Right. I think as well, it's easy for people who defend the flip to make arguments that Cochran himself can't make in the moment. Because we as viewers know some of the dynamics of Upolu, whereas Cochran isn't in a position to know that. Like you said on the previous podcast, all he knows about Upolu reliably is that they sort of kneel down in prayer after every event and talk about loyalty and things of the sort.
Yeah, I have a question about this season. I guess it's looking forward a bit more, but when it comes to the hidden immunity idol that Coach has, do you think if Cochran had known that Coach had been and was still to this day being deceitful to Brandon about how and when he found that idol, that Cochran would have stayed with Savai, or if anyone on Savai had known this really, that they would have stayed true, and then even if anyone but him draws the rock, he can at least bring that out and try to sever Upolu despite them having a numbers advantage?
I don't know if that would have played a big role in his decision in the moment, because firstly, you have to know about that, which is a difficult process itself. Secondly, you have to tell Brandon about it and have it not come back to bite you in the ass, because think about it. Brandon goes back to Coach and says, oh, Cochran told me this. If Coach is able to placate him, then Cochran automatically becomes the next person on the chopping block.
Yeah, and that's the risk you run. That's the danger of letting a leader like Coach take the, as we now commonly refer to, his network of goats with him, because you don't know if there's ever going to be an opportunity to get Coach out, because now mathematically to do so, you need one of his goats to flip on Coach.
Right.
And you run the risk anytime you try to even broach the subject with them of them just running back to Coach, and suddenly Coach with his automatic majority now means you're gone next. So it's a really, really tricky road.
It reminds me a lot of what we saw last season with Boston Rob, where we saw the conversation between Rob and Ashley, and then Natalie was able to jump up the ladder by selling out Ashley to Rob. We're getting through each other. It creates a situation where everyone has the incentive to toe the line when they might not have the same incentive otherwise.
Yeah, and honestly, I think those are the kind of spots that make me really love this game.
Yeah.
I think it's just absolutely fascinating.
I mean, in some ways it makes for boring TV, because when someone is dominating like that, you kind of know that they're going to go deep and probably win. But In another way, it's kind of fun to watch someone just have complete mastery over everything that happens in the game.
Yeah, see, Boston Rob put on an absolute clinic last year. What I didn't mean to say that I particularly enjoyed the Redemption Island season and that aspect of it, because honestly, obviously Survivor's a great show, that was not a great season because Boston Rob is so dominant. What I mean is that, kind of like with Andra and Candace, they need to vote together. But there are going to be certain times where it's not in their best interest to be voting together. And those are just an example. But people where it becomes this leveling game and this kind of Nash equilibrium thing where making your move optimally affects how other people's optimal moves. And then you have to react to those as well. And that's really, I think, the beauty of Survivor.
Right. I've said for a long time that I think that Survivor is less interesting strategically than games like Big Brother. But I think these are the subset of where Survivor leads to more interesting scenarios.
Yeah, definitely. Honestly, anything else you want to add about Cochrane?
That's about it for me.
All right. Yeah, I think I'm good for now. You know, we have next week, we're going to be going over the final sevens throughout his, not all of them, but the notable ones. Because honestly, if there's a time to make a move in Survivor, it's final nine, final seven, final five. And we are right at that spot in this season, and it's going to get good, and I can't wait to talk about it. And thanks so much for taking so much time today. I know we had some audio issues. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Dom, go ahead.
Yeah, just to echo what Colin said, if you made it this far, we salute you, because it's been a long podcast, fairly sort of dry, abstract topics, and also we've had audio issues and stuff, which hindered us getting this up and getting through it. So thank you for listening, and we hope to see you back again next week.
Absolutely.